Welcome to a study in the book of Hebrews. Our speaker, Dr. Ken Boa, is president of Reflections Ministries and Trinity House Publishers. Today, he looks at examples from the Old Testament. Here with our study is Dr. Ken Boa.
We've been exploring the whole idea of faith as being the apperception of that which is not seen over that which is seen, the pursuit of the invisible, the pursuit of the not yet over the now. And we saw that illustrated in the lives of a number of the figures in Hebrews chapter 11. We saw it illustrated in Enoch and in Noah. We saw it in Abraham and the other patriarchs. And then we looked at Moses and explored the fact that Moses was a man who bore the reproach of faith. We saw this in verse 25, where he chose rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. And he considered the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. So he experienced the reproach of the people because he recognized that his identity was in the promises of God. And so he has to make a choice, as all of us have to make. At the end of the day, you've got to make a choice as to whether the promises of this world, this fleeting world, will define you, or whether you're going to be defined by the promises of the living God. And it'll keep coming down to that. We saw as well that Moses was looking to a reward and recognized that the promises of God ultimately lead to a great good. And this reward we saw in verse 6 of Hebrews 11. Without faith, it's impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. And so this concept of reward, then, is very critical. What are you pursuing? What is the payoff? What is the reward that you're looking for? And again, Moses considered that even the best the world had to offer is as nothing in comparison to the promises of the living God. Because the world is passing away, but the one who does the will of God endures forever. So he's looking at it from the long-term perspective, as we also must do as well. That in this world we can be receiving many pleasures and so forth, but if we allow the pleasures, possessions, positions of this world to define us, at the end of the day we will not be able to walk with fidelity to the higher calling that God has made us for. God has called us for a purpose. He's called us to fidelity to that purpose, which is to pursue what he claims is important. The wisest thing you can do, as I often say, is to treat things according to their true value. The most foolish thing you can do is to treat the temporal as if it were going to last forever, and the eternal as if it were trivial. So the wise person then would actually treat things according to their true value. But may I promise you, you're not going to get the true value of things from what the world says. Am I correct about this? The fact is that the world will redefine things and tell us that what from the standpoint of God is despised, the world regards as esteemed. Jesus made that clear. That which is highly esteemed among men is despised in the sight of God. He told us in Luke 16. And so we have to make a choice between our value systems, what we're pursuing, and that will determine the course of our journey. So he left Egypt and didn't fear the wrath of the king. He endured as seeing him who was unseen. He kept the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood, so that he who destroyed the firstborn would not touch them. By faith they passed through the Red Sea as though they were passing through the dry land, and the Egyptians, when they attempted it, were drowned. Now he stops there with the story of Moses. Doesn't go into the wilderness wanderings. And the reason why the wilderness wanderings are not mentioned is because that's not illustrative of faith, but it's illustrative of disbelief. So instead, beginning in verse 30, we move into the story of Joshua, and then from there into Rahab. So we bump ahead these 40 years in the wilderness, 38 years of which were just wandering because of the rebellion of the people, 38 years, killing time, tent up, tent down, tent up, tent down, going in circles until at the end of the day, you kill time, and what do you kill? You kill life. And that whole generation, 20 years old and upwards, perished in the wilderness, except for Moses, Joshua, and Caleb. Now we move into the story of Joshua, and he mentions this particular thing. It's the only verse that's alluding to Joshua in this particular list. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down when they had been encircled for 7 days. Now, Joshua was Moses' successor as the leader of Israel, and he trusted the same God. If you looked at Exodus chapter 33, it's a very revealing little word about Joshua when he was a young man. And we see something about why God was able to use this man, because he was a person who pursued God. It says, 33:11, thus the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face, just as a man speaks to his friend. When Moses returned to the camp, his servant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, would not depart from the tent. The tent was the tent of meeting, and he would not depart from the tent. So right away we see that Joshua, even as a young man, had a desire to be in the presence of the God of Moses, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. So we see that very significant scene in his life. And then if we jumped ahead to Numbers chapters 13 to 14, there you find that that very kind of relationship that he had with God enabled him to see life from a different perspective. Whereas the 10 tribes saw it from a human perspective, 2 of the tribes, Joshua and Caleb, saw it from a divine point of view, and that made all the difference. And so he told them at Kadesh Barnea, do not draw back in disbelief, for God will bring us in. But they believed the majority report, and because of this, the people were consigned to basically wander for 38 years until everyone 20 years old and upward perished. Now, at that juncture then, we see another series of events that when Moses died, passed on the baton, the mantle of leadership over to Joshua. There's a scene in Joshua chapter 1 in verses 1 to 9 where God exhorts Joshua to be firm and to be courageous. And this image of the book of the law will not depart from your life, from your heart, but you'll meditate on it. And it was the key to Joshua's, I think, perspective, the key to his faith, was that he was a man of the word. And the book of the law, God's truth, was something that energized him and gave him the power to continue to take the risks of faith in spite of appearances to the contrary. And then the final scene of Joshua was found in Joshua 24:15, when he gathers all the elders of the people together and says, you've got to make a choice between whether you're going to serve the gods of the Amorites or the Egyptians, or whether you're going to serve the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But as for me and my house, we'll serve the Lord. And so right even there, to the very end, he had a firm disposition to embrace God's promises. So here's a man who began well, but he also finished well. And it's because he was a man of the word, it's because he was a man who had a passion for God's presence. And I encourage people to ask God for the grace for holy aspiration, to desire his presence, and to give them a desire to read the scriptures and for him to show up. So whenever you open the scriptures before God, it is always a good prayer to ask God's and invoke his manifest presence, so that he is present in the reading and that he will illuminate the scriptures. Because faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of Christ. So that as we read the scriptures, our faith will be amplified, because we are in fact enriching that connection with what the world would not teach. I often say that the world will define you by default. If you do nothing, the world will define you. But the word will only define you by discipline. You must do something there, or it will not happen. It's just the nature of this world as a fallen world, that to reinforce a bad habit requires no effort at all. You've noticed this. But to develop a good habit does require sustained effort. And that's just the way things are. Anything left to itself wears out. The only way you're going to make things better is by infusing it with energy and effort and intentionality. And that's where the spiritual disciplines come in. And so we will not grow in this perception of what God's about, what his rewards are. We will not be men and women of faith if we do not pursue the things that these others pursued, which was to pursue the invisible and the not yet, over the visible and the seen. So the walls of Jericho fell down. It's interesting, though, that before the walls of Jericho went down, Joshua's first act of real faith was not the defeat of the city. What was his first act of faith? If you recall, when he went across the Jordan River, and it divided, and they went across on dry land, just as it was with the parting of the Red Sea, so also God held back the river, and the people of Israel were able to walk across that. And it's significant to me as well that this first city, the conquest in the first city with Jericho, is not the sort of thing that you can really duplicate. I am told that the Army War College teaches some of the strategies of from Joshua, or at least it used to, some of the stratagems, the divide and conquer, the ambush, and a variety of other techniques that you'd find were very cleverly used, military stratagems that were very effective in the battles of Joshua against the Canaanites and the Amorites and so forth. Tremendous strategy and tactic. Now, one battle they do not teach is Jericho. And the reason for that is there's no way you can pull that one off. You see, the very first one, he says, you're not going to do this. I'm going to do it. You're going to watch and see what I do. And I'm going to ask you to do something that seems totally insane. I'm going to have you walk around, march around the city one time. And you're going to do that for 7 days. And then the seventh day, to make matters worse, you're going to go around there 7 times. And then you're going to sound the ram's horn, and you're going to play it very loud, and then the walls will come down. Well, if you heard that plan, wouldn't you want another idea? If God told you that's what my plan is, I'd say, anyone else have a better idea is what I'd probably be asking. Why on earth would Joshua then be willing, A, to pursue this plan, and why would God give him such an odd plan for the first city? And my belief is that Joshua pursued it because he trusted the living God, because he'd habituated that trust since he was a young man, and listening to the voice of God and manifest presence of God. But the other thing is that I believe God asked Joshua to do such a thing to show that all the conquest would really be done not by their prowess, but by God's power. And that is a perspective we need to embrace. So that the very first one illustrated that what power that I'm going to use, you will not do it, you will watch me do it. So that even though you will use good technique and so forth, and approaches and military strategies, you still need to understand that it'll be my power and not yours. It'll be my plans and not yours that will lead to the conquest of the cities. That was a paradigm that we had. So the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. People try to get around this miracle by a wide variety of ways. One of them is I heard somebody describe that, the sound vibrations from the trumpets made the walls crumble. You know, it takes a good deal more faith to believe that, if you really think about how big those walls were, than that God actually did it himself. We jump ahead, and still from the book of Joshua, we hear the story of Rahab the harlot. And Rahab, you know, the poor woman, she's known forever as Rahab the harlot. We never do find out her actual name apart from that, but she's known forever as Rahab the harlot. So how would that be? Imagine your chief disposition, your chief sin became your moniker for life. John the adulterer, Paul the murderer. This would not be a good way to live, would it? But at any rate, Rahab the harlot, that's the name we've been given. But in Joshua chapter 2, it's very significant that she comes up to the spies and she protects the spies and speaks about the fact that we heard about the things that you did. We heard about how God dried up the water of the Red Sea. We heard about the Exodus and how you defeated the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan. When we heard it, she says, our hearts melted, and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. This is Joshua 2:11. Then she makes this remarkable statement, for the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. And that's a very significant thing. This woman didn't know much, but what little she knew, she applied. And that's why she makes it into the hall of faith. The woman essentially was saved by grace because the other inhabitants of the city were marked out for destruction. But God, in His mercy and grace, permitted her and her family to be spared. She was saved also by faith. The reality was that it was by grace through faith, because she knew about God and she put her trust in Him. What little she knew, she applied. And she recognized He is the God in heaven above and on earth beneath. And that was her testimony, and God honored it. But she was also a woman who acted upon her faith. And this is where the choice that she made to protect the spies, and then, in obedience, to put the cord, the silver cord, in the window, as she was directed to do. And she evidently won her family to, because when they came, they would find the cord and they would pull her family out before the destruction of the city. And so she effectively obeyed God. She was delivered from judgment. In fact, if you jump with me to ahead over to the right to James chapter 2, you discover that she's listed here after Abraham. Then we hear the story of Rahab the harlot. In verse 25, in the same way, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out another way? And what I believe is happening here is she's saved into a faith that works. James's point, by the way, is that a faith that's alive is a faith that will work. And hers was evidently one of genuine belief. Very interesting, by the way, that she became a part of the nation of Israel. She married a man named Salmon. And Salmon gave birth to Boaz. You ever heard of him? And Boaz, as you know, was an ancestor of King David. So this pagan harlot becomes part of the ancestry of Jesus Christ. I find it very fascinating. And it illustrates again what faith can do. And it illustrates how the Pharisees knew much but applied little. Rahab knew little but applied much. That's why you don't hear the Pharisees in this list, but you hear of Rahab. Not because she knew a lot, but because she did much with what she, with what little she knew. And I think this is very critical, that God holds us accountable for the light we've got. And the more light you have, the more accountable you become. But revelation always requires a response. And it will do no good for us to just read the scriptures and then just close it and act as if you've never read it. James 1 uses this as an example of a person who looks at a mirror, sees his face, sees a problem, but then he stops looking at the mirror and acts as if he'd never seen anything. The word must be applied, and it's therefore application's the real critical issue here. We jump ahead. What more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets. So we see a wide variety of others. During the time of the judges, of course, we know about Gideon and Barak and their encouragements to us. Let me tell you why, because Gideon was a man who really had real lapses and questions about faith. It took him a good deal of time before his faith grew. That's why we hear about the whole idea of the fleece. Remember the two things with the fleece. First, it's going to be dry. The rest will be wet. Then let's try it again. Let's make this one be wet and the other be dry. He wanted to have that, and God in His grace put up with that and gave him. And then he did respond to what he was called to do. Barak won a victory over Sisera, but he unfortunately did not have enough faith to do it alone. He chose to require the help of a prophetess named Deborah, and when this occurred then, she shared the victory with him. But I like this fact that they're both included in this list. Why do I like that? Because we're like them. Our faith sometimes falters, and sometimes we have a firm and strong faith, and other times we draw back in disbelief. And so it's at least at the end of the day, though, they finished well, and that's what really matters. We hear Samson, a man of tremendous compromise, yet he's mentioned here because he at least trusted God at the very last act of his life. We hear of Jephthah, another one of the judges, the ninth judge, who, again, was very victorious and was used as a deliverer by God against the enemies of this people. Nevertheless, Jephthah had his problems as well. And you recall he made a rash vow that whatever would come out of his house first, he would dedicate to God. And that would be for destruction, for a sacrifice. His daughter came out. And I don't believe that it was actually going to be the fact that he sacrificed his daughter as a burnt offering. I think what happened would be Leviticus 27 talks about the law of vows. And I think he dedicated her to perpetual virginity, but nevertheless, it was still a rash vow. These people are people of whose feet are clay, and they choose to obey God. They withdraw, but on the whole, they still, at the end of the day, trusted in God, and they're included in this list. We hear of David, we hear of Samuel, and then he just mentions the prophets as a whole. Now, it's significant in verses 33 to 35, you hear of a variety of things that took place that we know about in Scripture. We hear about these people and others who by faith conquered kingdoms, verse 33. They performed acts of righteousness. They obtained promises. They shut the mouths of lions, and certainly we would think about Daniel in that context. They quenched the power of fire, and I think he's just alluding to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in that setting. They escaped the edge of the sword, and there were many who did. From weakness they were made strong, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. So through faith they were able to accomplish all these remarkable things, because they trusted in God, and God in each one of these cases delivered them. He goes on to say in verse 35, women received back their dead by resurrection. And you recall the story of Elijah and the resurrection of a child, and then Elisha does the same thing with the Shunammite's child. So some women received back their dead by resurrection. But then all of a sudden, right in the middle of verse 35, there's a radical change that takes place. You see, up to this point, we see people whose faith was honored by God in such a way that he transformed what appeared to be a situation that would lead to death or failure into great victory. In other words, these were overcomers through changed circumstances. But what's significant is then, after this list, we have a number of people who also were overcomers, but the circumstances did not change. And this is very important for us to see this sudden change. There's two categories then. There are those who trust in God and call upon his name, and he delivers them. But there are others, though, who are not delivered. And you recall again the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Remember, they said, our God is able to deliver us from the fire. But then what did they go on to say? Even if he doesn't, we'll still honor him. You see, they did not believe that there was a carte blanche, that there was a guarantee that everything they prayed for would happen the way they prayed. That they recognize that God has mysterious purposes and sometimes will not, in fact, answer those kinds of prayers. And he will do it, but he will answer it ultimately. So that it's important for us to see that there are going to be times when a person may be healed from a disease, and there may be times when, for one reason or another, they are not. When one person is delivered from this terrible opposition, and another time when they are not. When one person is martyred, and another person is delivered. And we know, by the way, that the Christian church is being persecuted more in this present time, right today, than ever in the history of the church. More believers are being persecuted for their faith than the world has ever seen in the history of the church. At the same time, by the way, the gospel is spreading more rapidly today than it ever has in the history of the church. All throughout Asia, Africa, South America. Remarkable things, so that the spiritual warfare is very intense. And we read of stories of people who have been delivered from those persecutions. We read of other stories of people who are martyred for their faith. There's no guarantee. Nor is it a question of whether one has more faith than another. The outcome does not determine the quantity of the faith. The faith is the issue of whether they're going to put their trust in God's promises. And ultimately, God may deliver them out of the pain and problems, or he may deliver them through it. He may deliver them ultimately through the doorway of death, which is a birth canal that leads to the fulfillment of God's true promises, where in this world we recognize we do not have the promises. Look again at verse 13. All these, he referred to, are died in faith without receiving the promises. You're not going to get them in this world. Sometimes God will answer your prayers in a certain way and sometimes in a different way. But even so, your full promises will not be revealed and received in this life. They welcomed them from a distance. And they confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. So we all must recognize that we, like them, are strangers and exiles. So in verse 35, right after saying, women receive back their dead by resurrection, he writes, others were tortured, not accepting their release, so that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others experienced mockings and scourgings, yes, also chains and imprisonment. I think a little bit about Jeremiah, who was one obvious example of such a man. 40 years this man is a prophet to the people. 40 years he's rejected by his people. He's thrown into a cistern. Everything he tells them to do, they do the opposite. That's a depressing life. I have to tell you, I do not really envy what he was given. It was a very difficult life he was given. Nevertheless, it's not the results that determine the fidelity. That he was faithful to the promises of God, and though at first he was reluctant and said, get somebody else to do it, he still obeyed the promises of God, and the ultimate results are in God's hands. They were stoned, they were sawn in two. One tradition says that Jeremiah was sawn in two, we don't know. They were tempted, they were put to death with the sword. They went about in sheepskins, in goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, men of whom the world was not worthy. Note that, by the way, that the world did not esteem them highly. The world had nothing but scorn for them. But at the end of the day, again, we have to decide whether faith will turn us from the approval of the world to the approval of the living God. And ultimately, that's the approval they sought. They were people of whom the world was not worthy, wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. And it says that all these, having gained approval through their faith, did not receive what was promised. I was speaking recently at a men's conference, and I was speaking about the fact that there are these two kinds of cases. There are those who, through faith, they find their circumstances changed, and God delivers them through changed circumstances out of those afflictions. But then I also pointed out, using this text, that there are others for whom their faith is not answered in that same manner, but that he does not change the circumstances, but still, ultimately, they cling to his character in spite of that pain. And I speak about this, and I spoke about this whole issue, that there's no assurance, there's no guarantee of healing, for example, on this earth. And I had one person raise an objection, and he's claiming that actually Jesus, because he healed everyone, that's a proof that everyone should be healed, which is an illegitimate connection. And then he tried to claim that the word that's used for healing is the same word used for salvation, which is a poor argument because a lot of words are used for different things depending on the context. World. God so loved the world. Then it says, do not love the world. And then says, he made the world. Those are three different uses of the same word, cosmos. The context will determine that. It was a shallow argument, but effectively his claim was if a person has enough faith, they should never have a disease. I told him, you know, you're going to die of your last disease. I told him that. He didn't buy that. I guess he has the illusion that he'll suddenly just die like that with no disease at all. Although my experience is when you die, you don't die of old age. There's always some pathology that's involved, you see, that none of us get out of here and escape that. In my view, such a mindset is not only unbiblical, but it is an incredibly cruel proposition. It's to make a person who is suffering, let's say from cancer, causing them to believe that if they only had enough faith, they would be healed. That's a shallow kind of an approach to take. It puts a burden of great guilt upon them. It's a name it, claim it kind of mindset. You know, name it, claim it, and frame it. Confess and possess. Receive and believe. You know, believe and receive. That sort of blab it and grab it. All those kinds of mindsets there that whatever you want to have, and you're almost looking at God as a kind of a cosmic vending machine. He's almost obligated if you have enough faith to do whatever you want him to do. And that is really not a biblical vision of what this life is like. At the end of the day, we're all terminal. And we need to recognize that God can deliver us, and I have seen miraculous deliverances and healings of various diseases. I have seen this. I have seen others who had the same amount of faith, but who were not delivered from those diseases. I refuse to believe that those people had less faith than the others, but they clung to his character. I often use Johnny Erickson Tada as the best example I know of this situation. And here's a person who was given that same kind of notion when she was 17 years old and became quadriplegic, through a terrible diving accident. She was given all this kind of material and these ideas. At the end of the day, she realized that God may be having a purpose. Some pain, some affliction, some adversity actually has a purpose. And it's silly for us to say that if we don't know what the purpose is, there can't be a good purpose. She herself discovered what that purpose was. And she said, though on the one hand I hate this wheelchair I'm in, and she's been in it for over 40 years, and it's not getting better, it's getting worse, because her bones are now going through atrophy, and it's actually leading to greater pain. Nevertheless, she says, in another way, I embrace this wheelchair, realizing if this is what it took for me to get to know God as I now do, I wouldn't have it any other way. In other words, she developed a quality of depth and maturity and character that I don't believe she would have developed any other way. Now, what is needful in one person's life is not the same as what another needs. God knows what each person needs and what they will do. And furthermore, I submit to you that the pain and adversity you go through is actually a vehicle God uses to forge and craft your life message, your ministry. It's through brokenness that we actually become people who, when we are weak, then he is strong. And we recognize if a person has been comforted by God in difficult times, 2 Corinthians 1 tells us that we are also then given the power to comfort others with the comfort with which we've received. And this is a very important idea. So I do not know what it's like to comfort a person who's lost a 2-year-old, but I know people who have lost 2-year-olds and who trusted Christ and honored him, and because of that, they have a power that I do not have to minister to people in that same situation. And my view here is that God shapes our lives, and through our victories and through our pains, he crafts a life message. And that no adversity is pointless or meaningless when we surrender our lives to him and ask him for his purpose to be done. It's my firm belief that in the university of life, there are a lot of courses that most of us would not take as electives. And some of these things were given as these things are not electives, they're required courses. I do not know why it is that some people's lives seem to be of relative ease, even though they're two people, one who is an ardent follower of Christ, another is an ardent follower of Christ. But one may have a life of relative ease, another of relative pain. But at the end of the day, God has purposes for both, and the outcome does not reveal the nature of the faith. At the end of the day, he calls us to be a people of fidelity who pursue him with diligence. As I conclude this chapter, he speaks about the fact that all these, referring to all these men and women of faith, both those who overcame and who were victorious through changed circumstances, and those who were victorious through unchanged circumstances, all of these died in faith. But they effectively this, it says they gained approval through their faith, did not receive what was promised. This is a very important point. They understood that they would not receive what was promised. Again, go back to verse 13. Because God had provided something better for us, so that apart from us they would not be made perfect. You see, many of these people saw a better blessing. We know that Abraham rejoiced to see my day and saw it and was glad, Jesus said. So there's a sense in which Abraham and others in the Old Testament had an anticipation of the one who would come, not fully, but there was a sense in which they knew that. And through the progress of Revelation, the messianic promises became more and more clear and evident. But still, no one could have fully guessed what it would all be about until Jesus himself came. And the idea that the suffering servant, that the Messiah is the suffering servant, would be the same as this Messiah who is the reigning king, no one would have guessed this. But indeed, both are one. And we discover then in the new covenant a better blessing. And that indeed, but the other side of the coin, Israel would have perished and the Messiah would not have been born if these men and women of faith in the old covenant did not actually pursue what he promised. So that these people's faith led ultimately to the birth of the Messiah, and that these better promises will reach back to the Old Testament saints as well. So that we could well say then, God has provided something better for us, this new covenant, so that apart from us, they would not be made perfect. So that in the fullness of the time when all these things are manifested, then they also receive the blessings of these promises. Without faith, we saw it's impossible to please God. And we go back again to the fact that as we study the Scriptures and as we are informed by what the Scriptures teach us, Romans 10:17, so faith comes from hearing, and hearing by the word of Christ. I have a couple of minutes for some Q&A if you want, because I don't want to launch into chapter 12. I think I'll wait on that until next time. Any questions? I'll repeat them if you have one. Yes, going back to the name it and claim it gospel.
Doesn't that concept elevate ego?
Yes, it's more of an ego thing. She's asking, does that mindset lead to the elevation of ourselves and to the mindset that we have certain powers? And I think that the problem is that's the case in many ways, because the supposition is, if my faith is strong enough, I will be able to bring this about, and God will virtually be obligated to pull them off. Any time you have that illusion that God's going to be obligated to do something if I have enough faith, that's called sympathetic magic. You see, it's effectively where you're using God as an instrument or a tool. You and I, we know that really prayer is very different from what we are often told to think. Many people tell us to suppose that prayer is something that we do, and we are our exercise of prayer is where we tell God about what our best interests look like and then tell him how to pull them off and win as well. We're very generous with all that. But I submit to you that's not really biblical prayer. Biblical prayer is not a matter of getting God to do what you want. It is actually more a matter of aligning your will with his. Now, at the same time, there are petitions, are there not? Aren't there intercessions? My answer to that is that when you make a petition for yourself or intercede for another, those prayers of supplication then are requesting something. My perspective on this is that you surely should be honest and open with God about what you desire, but you must never turn a desire into a demand. There's an enormous difference between one and the other. And demand, I get that because I did the right things. I had enough faith and I believe this and I'm going to name it and claim it. Rather, I offer this up to God, but I always know, but God, you know what's best. You've got to believe that you don't know what your best interests look like. You think you do, you don't. None of us know what our best interests look like. I've told you this many times. You'd have to know the future to know what they look like. You'd have to know the outcome. What appears to be your best interests, from our standpoint, may well turn out to be a real dead end, a disaster. And we've all heard about some prayers that people have made, and I've made some prayers in the past that's really good that you didn't answer them the way I had in mind. I'd be ruined. Thank God for unanswered prayer sometimes. So I recognize that God knows what's best, so I offer up my desires, I'm honest with him about them, but I also say, but you know. And so I let loose of that. the desire then, the simplicity would be that I'd be honoring to him and pleasing to him.
Two aspects of that. And I believe like you do. But how do you ask somebody to give you the verse if you have faith of a grain of mustard?
Yeah.
Say that mountain move.
Yes. So the first one was the verse that she was referring to, if you have enough faith as a mustard seed, you can move a mountain and so forth, and that if Jesus were here, would he heal you? And as to the first, my approach is to say you've got to collect all the scriptures when it deals with the issue of prayer and faith and so forth. And if you just camp on one verse as a hobby horse, and just say, you see, if you have enough faith, everything you ask for, it'll be given to you. But then, as it turns out, there are a lot of other verses that nuance that idea. Because if a person does not ask in faith, or if a person asks for selfishly, you don't have because you don't ask, but you ask and don't receive because you've asked it with selfish motives. If you begin to multiply those texts, you begin to realize that this will of God and this answer of prayer is a matter of a relationship, not a technique. And so that idea then is very important for us to see. It's a paradigm shift, though, it really is. And the if about Jesus is not a meaningful question because he's not here. The what if kind of question doesn't really hold a lot of water for me. Yeah, if you were there and he was there, and if you had no faith, but you see, even there, he didn't heal everybody because there were some who didn't have much faith, and so he did not perform miracles, as you recall. In his own hometown, there were contexts where he did not do that because of their disbelief. And so you don't want to reduce God down to some construct that's controllable and measurable and quantifiable. Bill.
I heard Arsenis Sproul on the radio say that probably the greatest refutation of that is Christ's prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane.
Yeah, that's a good one. The refutation of that's also Christ's prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane. He wasn't delivered. And he certainly asked for that, but he also said, here's the key, what did he do? Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. And that's the end of the day. So you offer up your petition, but you also realize that your will is not God's, always God's will, and God always wills what's best for you. And it's with that perspective that we become people who are more than overcomers in spite of circumstances and appearances to the contrary. Lord, we thank you for this lesson from Hebrews. We thank you for these men and women of faith who have overcome through changed circumstances and through unchanged circumstances. May we be people who then trust you implicitly and call upon your name and offer up our petitions, but also trust that you know what is best for us. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this talk, which is part of a series of messages by Dr. Ken Boa. To order additional talks on CD or MP3, or to learn about any of Dr. Boa's other Bible-based teachings, go to our web ministry at kenboa.org. That's kenboa.org. Or call 1-800-DRAW-NEAR. That's 1-800-372-9632.